Uwe carefully shovels snow outside his house. When he's done with that, he stands outside his shed, leaning on his snow shovel, looking at the line of row houses. Then he crosses the road and starts clearing snow in front of the other houses. Chapter 25. A man called Uwe and a piece of corrugated iron. Uwe waits till after breakfast. Once he's let the cat out, only then does he take down a plastic bottle from the top shelf in the bathroom. He weighs it in his hand as if he's about to throw it somewhere, rattles it lightly to see if many pills are left. Towards the end, the doctors prescribed so many painkillers for Sonia. Their bathroom still looks like a storage facility for the Colombian mafia. Uwe obviously doesn't trust medicine, has always been convinced its only real effects are psychological, and as a result, it only works on people with feeble brains. But it's only just struck him that chemicals are not at all an unusual way of taking one's life. He hears something outside the front door. The cat is back surprisingly quickly, scraping its paws by the threshold and sounding like it's been caught in a steel trap, as if it knows what's going through Uva's mind. Uwe can understand that it's disappointed in him. He can't possibly expect it to understand his actions. He thinks about how it would feel, doing it this way. He has never taken any narcotics, has hardly even been affected by alcohol, has never liked the feeling of losing control. He's come to realize over the years that it's this very feeling that normal folk like and strive for, but as far as Uwe is concerned, only a complete bloody airhead could find loss of control a state worth aiming for. He wonders if he'll feel nauseated, if he'll feel pain when his body's organs give up and stop functioning. Or will he just go to sleep when his body becomes unfit for use? By now, the cat is howling out there in the snow. Uwe closes his eyes and thinks of Sonia. It's not that he's the sort of man who gives up and dies. He doesn't want her to think that. But it's actually wrong. All this. She married him, and now he doesn't quite know how to carry on without the tip of her nose and the pit between his throat and his shoulder. That's all. He unscrews the lid and distributes the pills along the edge of the wash basin, watches them as if expecting them to transform into little murderous robots. Of course they don't. Uwe is unimpressed. He finds it quite inexplicable how those little white dots could do him any harm, regardless of how many of them he takes. The cat sounds as if it's spitting snow all over Uva's front door. But then it's interrupted by another quite different sound. A dog barking. Uwe looks up. It's quiet for a few seconds. And then he hears the cat yowling with pain, then more barking, and blonde weed roaring something. Uwe stands there gripping the wash basin, closes his eyes as if he could blink the sound out. It doesn't work. Then, at last, he sighs and straightens up, unscrews the lid of the bottle, pushes the pills back into it, goes down the stairs. As he crosses the living room, he puts the jar on the windowsill. And through the window, he sees blonde weed in the road, taking aim and then rushing towards the cat. Uwe opens the door exactly as she's about to kick the animal in the head with all her strength. The cat quickly dodges her needle-sharp heel and backs away towards Uva's tool shed. Mutt growls hysterically, saliva flying around its head as if it were a rabies-infected beast. There's fur in its jaws. This is the first time Uwe can remember having seen weed without her sunglasses. Malevolence glitters in her green eyes. She pulls back, preparing for another kick, then catches sight of Uwe and stops herself mid-flow. Her lower lip is trembling with anger. "I'll have that thing shot," she hisses and points at the cat. Very slowly, Uwe shakes his head without taking his eyes off her. She swallows. Something about his expression, as if sculpted from a seam of rock, makes her murderous assurance falter. "It's a fucking street cat, and it's gonna die. It's scratched prints," she stammers. Uwe doesn't say anything, but his eyes turn black, and in the end, even the dog backs away from him. "Come on, Prince," she says, disappearing around the corner as if Uwe had physically shoved her from behind. Uwe stays where he is, breathing heavily. He presses his fist to his chest, feels the uncontrolled beating of his heart. He groans a little, then he looks at the cat. The cat looks back at him. There's a new wound down its flank, blood in its fur again.
"Nine lives won't last you very long, will they?" says Uva.
The cat licks its paw and looks as if it's not the sort of cat that likes to keep count. Uva nods and steps aside.
"Get inside, then."
The cat traipses in over the threshold. Uva closes the door. He stands in the middle of the living room. Everywhere, Sonia looks back at him. Only now does it strike him that he's positioned the photographs so they follow him through the house wherever he goes. She's on the table in the kitchen, hangs on the wall in the hall and halfway up the stairs. She's on the window shelf in the living room where the cat has now jumped up and sits right beside her. It sends Uva a disgruntled look as it sweeps the pills onto the floor with a crash. When Uva picks up the bottle, the cat looks at him in horror, as if to shout, "J'accuse!" Uva kicks a little at a baseboard, then turns around and goes into the kitchen to put the pill bottle in a cupboard. Then he makes coffee and pours water in a bowl for the cat. They drink in silence. Uva picks up the empty bowl and puts it next to his coffee cup in the sink. He stands with his hands on his hips for a good while, then turns around and goes into the hall.
"Tag along, then," he urges the cat without looking at it. "Let's give that village cur something to think about."
Uva puts on the navy winter jacket, steps into his clogs, and lets the cat walk out the door first. He looks at the photo of Sonia on the wall. She laughs back at him. "Maybe it's not so enormously important to die that it can't wait another hour," thinks Uva, and follows the cat into the street. He goes to Rune's house, where it takes several minutes before the door opens. There's a slow, dragging sound inside before anything happens with the lock, as if a ghost is approaching with heavy chains rattling behind it. Then, finally, it opens, and Rune stands there looking at Uva and the cat with an empty stare.
"Got any corrugated iron?"
wonders Uva, without allowing any time for small talk. Rune gives him a concentrated stare for a second or two, as if his brain is fighting desperately to produce a memory.
"Corrugated iron,"
he says to himself, as if tasting the word, like someone who's just woken up and is intensely trying to remember what he's been dreaming.
"Corrugated iron, that's it," says Uva with a nod.
Rune looks at him, or rather he looks straight through him. His eyes have the gleam of a newly waxed car hood. He's emaciated and hunchbacked. His beard is gray, bordering on white. This used to be a solid bloke, commanding a bit of respect, but now his clothes hang on his body in rags. He's grown old, very, very old, Uva realizes, and it hits him with a force he hadn't quite counted on. Rune's gaze flickers for a moment, then his mouth starts twitching.
"Uva?"
he exclaims.
"Yeah, well, one thing's for sure, I'm not the Pope," Uva replies.
The baggy skin on Rune's face cracks into a sleepy smile. Both men, once as close as men of that sort could be, stare at each other. One of them, a man who refuses to forget the past, and one who can't remember it at all.
"You look old," says Uva.
Rune grins. Then Anita's anxious voice makes itself heard, and in the next moment, her small drumming feet are bearing her at speed towards the door.
"Is there someone at the door, Rune? What are you doing there?" she calls out, terrified as she appears in the doorway. Then she sees Uva.
"Oh, hello, Uva," she says and stops abruptly.
Uva stands there with his hands in his pockets. The cat beside him looks as if it would do the same if it had pockets. Or hands. Anita is small and colorless in her gray trousers, gray knitted cardigan, gray hair, and gray skin. But Uva notices that her face is slightly red-eyed and swollen. Quickly, she wipes her eyes and blinks away the pain, as women of that generation do. As if they stood in the doorway every morning, determinedly driving sorrow out of the house with a broom. Tenderly, she takes Rune by the shoulders and leads him to his wheelchair by the window in the living room.
"Hello, Uva," she repeats in a friendly, also surprised voice when she comes back to the door. What can I do for you?
Do you have any corrugated iron? He asks back.
She looks puzzled.
Corrected iron?
She mumbles, as if the iron has somehow been wrong and now someone has to put it right. Uwe sighs deeply.
Good God, corrugated iron.
Anita doesn't look the slightest bit less puzzled. Am I supposed to have some?
Rune will have some in his shed, definitely, says Uwe and holds out his hand.
Anita nods, takes down the shed key from the wall and puts it in Uwe's hand.
Corrugated? Iron? She says again.
Yes, says Uwe.
But we don't have a metal roof.
What's that got to do with it?
Anita shakes her head.
No, maybe it doesn't, of course.
One always has a bit of sheet metal, says Uwe, as if this was absolutely beyond dispute.
Anita nods, as one does when faced with the undeniable fact that a bit of corrugated iron is the sort of thing that all normal, right-thinking people keep lying about in their sheds just in case there's call for it.
But don't you have any of that metal yourself, then?
She tries, mainly to have something to talk about.
I've used mine up, says Uwe.
Anita nods understandingly. As one does when facing the indisputable fact that there's nothing odd about a normal man without a metal roof getting through his corrugated iron at such a rate that it runs out. A minute later, Uwe turns up triumphantly in the doorway, dragging a gigantic piece of corrugated iron as big as a living room rug. Anita honestly has no idea how such a large piece of metal has even fitted in there without her knowing about it.
Told you. Uwe says with a nod, giving her back the key.
Yes. Yes, you did, didn't you?
Anita feels obliged to admit. Uwe turns to the window. Rune looks back. And just as Anita turns around to go back into the house, Rune grins again and lifts his hand in a brief wave. As if right there, just for a second, he knew exactly who Uwe was and what he was doing there. Anita stops hesitantly, turns around.
They've been here from social services again. They want to take Rune away from me, she says without looking up.
Her voice cracks like dry newspaper when she speaks her husband's name. Uwe fingers the corrugated iron.
They say I'm not capable of taking care of him, with his illness and everything. They say he has to go into a home, she says.
Uwe continues fingering the corrugated iron.
He'll die if I put him in a home, Uwe, you know that.
She whispers.
Uwe nods and looks at the remains of a cigarette butt, frozen in the crack between two paving stones. Out of the corner of his eye, he notices how Anita is sort of leaning slightly to one side.
Sonia explained about a year ago that it was the hip replacement operation, he remembers. Her hands shake as well these days.
The first stage of multiple sclerosis, Sonia had also explained. And a few years ago, Rune got Alzheimer's as well.
Your lad can come and give you a hand, then? He mumbles in a low voice.
Anita looks up, looks into his eyes, and smiles indulgently.
Johan? He lives in America, you know. He's got enough on his own plate. You know how young people are.
Uwe doesn't answer. Anita says America as if it were the kingdom of heaven where her egotistical son has moved. Not once has Uwe seen that brat here on the street since Rune sickened. Grown man now, but no time for his parents. Anita jumps to attention as if she's caught herself doing something disreputable. She smiles apologetically at Uwe.
Sorry, Uwe, I shouldn't stand here taking up your time with my nattering.
She goes back into the house. Uwe stays where he is with the sheet of corrugated iron in his hand and the cat at his side. He mutters something to himself just before the door is closed. Anita turns around in surprise, peers out of the crack, and looks at him.
Pardon me?
Uwe twists without meeting her eyes. Then he turns and starts to leave, while his words slip out of him involuntarily.
I said if you have any more problems with those bloody radiators, you can come and ring my doorbell. The cat and me are at home.
Anita's furrowed face pulls itself into a surprised smile. She takes half a step out the door as if she wants to say something more. Maybe something about Sonia, how deeply she misses her best friend. How she misses what they had, all four of them, when they first moved onto this street almost 40 years ago. How she even misses the way Rune and Uva used to argue. But Uva has already disappeared around the corner. Back in his tool shed, Uva fetches the spare battery for the Saab and two large metal clips. He lays out the sheet of corrugated iron across the paving stones between the shed and the house and carefully covers it with snow. He stands next to the cat, evaluating his creation for a long time. A perfect dog trap, hidden under snow, bursting with electricity, ready to bite. It seems a wholly proportionate revenge. The next time Blonde Weed passes by with that bloody mud of hers and the latter gets the idea of peeing on Uva's paving, it'll do so onto an electrified, conductive metal plate. And then let's see how amusing they find it, Uva thinks to himself. The cat tilts its head and looks at the metal sheet.
Like a bolt of lightning up your urethra, says Uva.
The cat looks at him for a long time as if to say, you're not serious, are you? Eventually, Uva sticks his hands in his pockets and shakes his head.
No, no, I suppose not, he sighs glumly.
And then he packs up the battery and clamps and corrugated iron and puts everything in the garage. Not because he doesn't think those morons deserve a proper electric shock, because they do, but because he knows it's been a while since someone reminded him of the difference between being wicked because one has to be or because one can.
It's a bloody good idea, though, he concludes to the cat as they go back into the house.
The cat goes into the living room and the dismissive body language of someone mumbling, sure, sure it was. And then they have lunch. Chapter 26 A man called Uva and a society where no one can repair a bicycle anymore. Many people find it difficult living with someone who likes to be alone. It grates on those who can't handle it themselves. But Sonia didn't whine more than she had to. I took you as you were, she used to say. But Sonia was not so silly that she didn't understand that even men like Uva liked to have someone to talk to now and then. It had been quite a while since he'd had that.
I won, Uva says curtly when he hears the slamming of the mailbox.
The cat jumps off the windowsill in the living room and goes into the kitchen. Bad loser, thinks Uva, and goes to the front door. It's been years since he last made a bet with someone about what time the mail would come. He used to make bets with Rune when they were on vacation in the summers, which grew so intensive that they developed complex systems of marginal extensions and half-minutes to determine who was most accurate. That was how it was back in those days. The mail arrived at 12 o'clock on the dot. So one needed precise demarcations to be able to say who had guessed right. Nowadays, it isn't like that. Nowadays, the mail can be delivered halfway through the afternoon, any old way it pleases. The post office takes care of it when it feels like it, and you just have to be grateful and that's it. Uva tried to make bets with Sonia after he and Rune stopped talking, but she didn't understand the rules, so he gave up. The youth barely manages to avoid being knocked off the steps when Uva throws the door open. Uva looks at him in surprise. He's wearing a postman's uniform.
Yes, demands Uva.
The youth looks like he can't come up with an answer. He fiddles with a newspaper and a letter. And that's when Uva notices that it's the same youth who argued with him about that bicycle a few days ago by the storage shed. The bicycle the youth said he was going to fix. Of course, Uva knows what that means. Fix means steal and sell on the internet to these rascals. That's the long and short of it. The youth looks, if possible, even less thrilled about recognizing Uva than vice versa. He looks a little like a waiter sometimes does, when he's undecided about whether to serve you your food or take it into the kitchen and spit on it. The lad looks coolly at Uva before reluctantly handing the mail over with a grumpy, "There you go." Uva accepts it without taking his eyes off him. Your mailbox is smashed, so I was going to give you these, says the youth. He nods at the folded double pile of junk that used to be Uva's mailbox until the lanky one, who can't back up with a trailer, backed his trailer into it, then nods at the letter and newspaper in Uva's hand. Uwe looks down at them. The newspaper is one of those local rags they hand out for nothing, even when one puts up a sign quite expressly telling them to do no such bloody thing. And the letter is most likely advertising, Uwe imagines. Admittedly, his name and address have been written in longhand on the front, but that's a typical advertising trick, to make one think it's a letter from a real person, and then one opens it, and in a flash, one has been subjected to marketing. That trick won't work on Uwe. The youth stands there, rocking on his heels and looking down at the ground, as if he's struggling with something inside that wants to come out.
Is there something else? Uwe wonders.
The youth pulls his hand through his greasy, late pubescent shock of hair. Ah, what the hell. I was just wondering if you have a wife called Sonia, he manages to say. Uwe looks suspicious. The lad points at the envelope. I saw the surname. I had a teacher with that name. Was just wondering. He seems to be cursing himself for having said anything. He spins around on the spot and starts walking away. Uwe clears his throat and kicks the threshold.
Wait, that could be right. What about Sonia?
The lad stops a yard farther away.
Ah, shit. I just liked her, that's all I wanted to say. I'm not so good at reading and writing and all that.
Uwe almost says, I'd never have guessed. But he leaves it. The youth twists awkwardly, runs his hand through his hair, somewhat disoriented as if he's hoping to find the appropriate words up there somewhere. She's the only teacher I ever had who didn't think I was thick as a plank, he mumbles, almost choking on his emotion. She got me reading that Shakespeare, you know? I didn't know I could even read, sort of thing. She got me reading the most hardcore thick book and all. It felt really shit when I heard she died, you know?
Uwe doesn't answer.
The youth looks down at the ground, shrugs. That's it.
He's silent.
And then they both stand there, the 59-year-old and the teenager, a few yards apart, kicking at the snow, as if they were kicking a memory back and forth, a memory of a woman who insisted on seeing more potential in certain men than they saw in themselves. Neither of them knows what to do with their shared experience.
What are you doing with that bike? Says Uwe at last.
I promised to fix it up for my girlfriend. She lives there. The youth answers, nodding at the house at the far end of their row, opposite Anita and Rune's place, the one where those recycling types live when they're not in Thailand or wherever they go. Or, you know, she's not my girlfriend yet, but I'm thinking I'm wanting her to be, sort of thing. Uwe scrutinizes the youth as middle-aged men often scrutinize younger men who seem to invent their own grammar as they go along.
So have you got any tools then? He asks.
The youth shakes his head.
How are you going to repair a bike without tools?
Uwe marvels, more with genuine surprise than agitation. The youth shrugs.
Dunno. Why'd you promise to repair it then?
The youth kicks the snow, scratches his face with his entire hand, embarrassed.
Because I love her?
Uwe can't quite decide what to say to that one, so he rolls up the local newspaper and envelope and slaps it into his palm like a baton. I have to get going, the youth mumbles almost inaudibly, and makes a movement to turn around again.
Come over after work then, and I'll get the bike out for you.
Uwe's words seem to pop up out of nowhere.
But you have to bring your own tools, he adds.
The youth brightens up.
You serious, man?
Uwe continues, slapping the paper baton into his hand. The youth swallows.
Awesome! Wait, shit, I can't pick it up today, I have to go to my other job, but tomorrow, man, I can come tomorrow. Is it cool if I pick it up tomorrow, like, instead?
Uwe tilts his head and looks as if everything that's just been said came from the mouth of a character in an animated film. The youth takes a deep breath and pulls himself together.
What other job?
Asks Uwe, as if he's had an incomplete answer in the final of Jeopardy.
I sort of work in a cafe in the evenings and at the weekends, says the youth,
with that new one hope in his eyes about perhaps being able to rescue his fantasy relationship with a girlfriend who doesn't even know that she's his girlfriend, the sort of relationship that only a boy in late puberty with greasy hair can have.
I need both jobs because I'm saving money, he explains. For what?
A car. Uwe can't avoid noticing how he straightens up slightly when he says car. Uwe looks dubious for a moment. Then he slowly but watchfully slaps the baton into his palm again.
What sort of car?
I had a look at a Renault, the youth says brightly, stretching a little more. The air around the two men stops for a hundredth of a breath or so.
An eerie silence suddenly envelops them.
If this were a scene from a film, the camera would very likely have time to pan 360 degrees around them before Uwe finally loses his composure.
Renault! Renault? That's bloody French! You can't bloody well go and buy a French car!
The youth seems just about to say something, but he doesn't get the chance before Uwe shakes his whole upper body as if trying to get rid of a persistent wasp.
Christ, you puppy, don't you know anything about cars?
The youth shakes his head.
Uwe sighs deeply and puts his hand on his forehead, as if he's been struck by a sudden migraine.
And how are you going to get the bicycle to the cafe if you don't have a car?
He says at long last, visibly struggling to regain his composure. I hadn't thought about that, says the youth.
Uwe shakes his head.
Renault! Christ almighty!
The youth nods. Uwe rubs his eyes in frustration.
Where's the sodden cafe you work at, then? He mutters.
20 minutes later, Parvana opens her front door in surprise. Uwe is standing outside, thoughtfully striking his hand with a paper baton.
Have you got one of those green signs?
What?
You have to have one of those green signs when you're a student driver. Do you have one or not?
She nods.
Yeah, yes, I have, but what?
I'll come and pick you up in 2 hours. We'll take my car.
Uwe turns around and tramps back across the little road without waiting for an answer. Chapter 27
A Man Called Uwe and a Driving Lesson. It happened now and then in the almost 40 years they lived in the row of row houses that some thoughtless and recently moved-in neighbor was bold enough to ask Sonia what the real cause was for the deep animosity between Uwe and Rune. Why had two men who had once been friends suddenly started hating one another with such overpowering intensity? Sonia usually answered that it was quite straightforward. It was simply about how when the two men and their wives moved into their houses, Uwe drove a Saab 96 and Rune a Volvo 244. A year or so later, Uwe bought a Saab 95 and Rune bought a Volvo 245. 3 years later, Uwe bought a Saab 900 and Rune bought a Volvo 265. In the decades that followed, Uwe bought another two Saab 900s and then a Saab 9000. Rune bought another Volvo 265 and then a Volvo 745. But a few years later, he went back to a sedan model and acquired a Volvo 740. Whereupon Uwe bought yet one more Saab 9000, and Rune eventually went over to a Volvo 760, after which Uwe got himself a Saab 9000i, and Rune part-exchanged to a Volvo 760 Turbo. And then the day came when Uwe went to the car dealer to look at the recently launched Saab 9-3, and when he came home in the evening, Rune had bought a BMW.
A BMW, Uwe had roared at Sonia. How can you reason with a human being like that? How?
And possibly it was not the entire explanation for why these two men loathed one another, Sonia used to explain. Either you understood it, or you didn't. And if you didn't understand, there was no point even trying to clarify the rest.
Most people never did understand, Uwe often commented.
But then people had no idea of loyalty these days. The car was just a means of transport, and the road just a complication arising between two points. Uwe is convinced this is why the roads are as bad as they are. If people were a little more careful with their cars, they wouldn't drive like idiots, he thinks, watching with concern as Parvana pushes away the newspaper he has spread across her seat. She has to retract the driver's seat as far as it'll go, so she can maneuver her pregnant belly into the car, then bring it forward all the way so she can reach the wheel. The driving lesson doesn't start so well. Or to be precise, it begins with Parvana trying to get into the Saab with a bottle of carbonated juice in her hand. She shouldn't have done that. Then she tries to fiddle with Uwe's radio to find a more entertaining station. She shouldn't have done that either. Uwe picks up the newspaper from the floor, rolls it up, and starts nervously striking it against his hand, like a more aggressive version of a stress ball. She grabs the wheel and looks at the instruments like a curious child.
"Where do we start?"
she yells eagerly, after at long last agreeing to hand over the juice. Uva sighs. The cat sits in the back seat and looks as if it wished, with intensity, that cats knew how to strap on safety belts.
"Press the clutch pedal," says Uva, slightly grim.
Parvana looks around her seat as if searching for something. Then she looks at Uva and smiles, ingratiatingly.
"Which one's the clutch?"
Uva's face fills with disbelief. She looks around the seat again, turns toward the seatbelt fixture in the backrest, as if she may find the clutch there. Uva holds his forehead. Parvana's facial expression immediately sours.
"I told you I want a driver's license for an automatic. Why did you make me use your car?"
"Because you're getting a proper license."
Uva cuts her short, emphasizing proper in a way that makes it plain that a license for an automatic is as much a proper driver's license as a car with an automatic gearbox is a proper car.
"Stop shouting at me," shouts Parvana.
"I'm not shouting," Uva shouts back.
The cat curls up in the back seat, clearly anxious not to end up in the middle of this, whatever it is. Parvana crosses her arms and glares out of the side window. Uva strikes his paper baton rhythmically into the palm of his hand.
"The pedal on the far left is the clutch," he grunts in the end.
After taking a breath so deep that he has to stop halfway for a rest before he inhales again, he continues.
"The one in the middle is the brake. On the far right is the accelerator. You release the clutch slowly until you find the point where it engages. Then give it a bit of gas, release the clutch, and move off."
Parvana seems to accept this as an apology. She nods and calms down, takes hold of the steering wheel, starts the car, and follows his instructions. The Saab lurches forward with a little jump, then pauses before catapulting itself with a loud roar towards the guest parking, and very nearly crashing into another car. Uva tugs at the handbrake. Parvana lets go of the steering wheel and yells in panic, covering her eyes with her hands until the Saab finally comes to an abrupt stop. Uva is puffing as if he'd had to make his way to the handbrake by forcing himself through a military obstacle course. His facial muscles twitch like a man whose eyes are being sprayed with lemon juice.
"What do I do now?"
roars Parvana when she realizes that the Saab is an inch from the taillights of the car in front.
"Reverse! You put it in reverse!"
Uva manages to say through his teeth.
"I almost smashed into that car," pants Parvana.
Uva peers over the edge of the hood, and then, suddenly, a sort of calm comes over his face. He turns and nods at her, very matter-of-fact.
"Doesn't matter. It's a Volvo."
It takes them 15 minutes to get out of the parking area and onto the main road. Once they're there, Parvana revs the first gear until the Saab vibrates like it's about to explode. Uva tells her to change gear, and she replies that she doesn't know how. Meanwhile, the cat seems to be trying to open the back door. When they get to the first red light, a big black SUV with two shaven-headed young men in the front pulls up so close to their rear bumper that Uva is pretty sure he'll have their license number etched into his paintwork when they get home. Parvana glances nervously in the mirror. The SUV revs its engine as if giving vent to some sort of opinion. Uva turns and looks out the back window. The two men have tattoos all over their throats, he notes, as if the SUV is not a clear enough advertisement for their stupidity. The light turns green. Parvana brings up the clutch. The Saab splutters and the instrument panel goes black. Stressed, Parvana turns the key in the ignition, which only makes it grind in a heart-rending manner. The engine makes a roar, coughs, and dies anew. The men with the shaved heads and tattooed throats sound the horn. One of them gestures.
"Press down the clutch and give it more gas," says Uva.
"That's what I'm doing," she answers.
"That's not what you're doing."
"Yes, I am."
"Now you're shouting."
"I'm not bloody shouting,"
she shouts. The SUV blares its horn. Parvana presses down the clutch. The Saab rolls backwards a few inches and bumps into the front of the SUV. The throat tattoos are now hanging on the horn as if it's an air raid alarm. Gravana tugs despairingly at the key, only to be rewarded by yet another stall. Then, suddenly, she lets go of everything and hides her face in her hands.
Good God, are you crying now?
Uva asks in amazement.
I'm not bloody crying,
she howls, her tears spattering all over the dashboard. Uva leans back and looks down at his knee, fingers the end of the paper baton.
It's just such a strain, this, do you understand?
She sobs, and leans her forehead against the wheel as if hoping it might be soft and fluffy.
I'm sort of pregnant. I'm just a bit stressed. Can no one show a bit of understanding for a pregnant bloody woman who's a bit stressed?
Uva twists uncomfortably in the passenger seat. She punches the steering wheel several times, mumbles something about how all she wants to do is drink some bloody lemonade, flops her arms over the top of the steering wheel, buries her face in her sleeves, and starts crying again. The SUV behind them honks until it sounds as if the Finland ferry is about to run them down. And then something in Uva snaps. He throws the door open, gets out of the car, walks slowly around the SUV, and rips the driver's door open.
Have you never been a student driver or what?
The driver doesn't have time to answer.
You stupid little bastard!
Uva roars in the face of the shaven-headed young man with throat tattoos, his spittle cascading over their seats. The throat tattoo doesn't have time to answer, and Uva doesn't wait for him either. Instead, he grabs the young man by his collar and pulls him up so hard that his body tumbles clumsily out of the car. He's a muscular sort, easily weighing in at 200 pounds, but Uva holds his collar in an immovable steel grip. Evidently, throat tattoo is so surprised by the strength in the old man's grip that it doesn't occur to him to put up any resistance. Fury burns in Uva's eyes as he presses the probably 35 years younger man so hard against the side of the SUV that the bodywork creaks. He places the tip of his index finger in the middle of the shaved head and positions his eyes so close to throat tattoo's face that they feel each other's breath.
If you sound that horn one more time, it'll be the last thing you do on this earth, got it?
Throat tattoo allows his eyes to divert quickly towards his equally muscular friend inside the car, and then at the growing line of other cars behind the SUV. No one is making the slightest move to come to his assistance. No one beeps. No one moves. Everyone seems to be thinking the same thing. If a non-throat tattooed man of Uva's age without any hesitation steps up to a throat tattooed man of the age of this throat tattoo and presses him up against a car in this manner, then it's very likely not the throat tattooed man one should be most worried about annoying. Uva's eyes are black with anger. After a short moment of reflection, throat tattoo seems convinced by the argument that the old man unmistakably means business. The tip of his nose almost unnoticeably moves up and down. Uva nods by way of confirmation and lets him back down on the ground. Then turns around, walks around the SUV, and gets back into the Saab. Parvana stares at him with her mouth hanging open.
Now, you listen to me, says Uva calmly while he carefully closes the door. You've given birth to two children, and quite soon you'll be squeezing out a third. You've come here from a land far away, and most likely you fled war and persecution and all sorts of other nonsense. You've learned a new language and got yourself an education, and you're holding together a family of obvious incompetence. And I'll be damned if I've seen you afraid of a single bloody thing in this world before now.
Uva rivets his eyes into her. Parvana is still agape. Uva points imperiously at the pedals under her feet.
I'm not asking for brain surgery. I'm asking you to drive a car. It's got an accelerator, a brake, and a clutch. Some of the greatest twits in world history have sorted out how it works, and you will as well.
And then he utters seven words, which Parvana will always remember as the loveliest compliment he'll ever give her.
Because you are not a complete twit.
Parvana pushes a ringlet of hair out of her face, sticky with tears. Clumsily, she once again grabs hold of the steering wheel with both hands. Uva nods, puts on his safety belt, and makes himself comfortable.
Now, push the clutch down and do what I say.
And that afternoon, Parvana learns to drive. Chapter 28. A man who was Uva
and a man who was Rune. Sonia used to say that Uwe was unforgiving. For instance, he refused to go back to the local bakery, 8 years after they gave him the wrong change when he bought pastries once at the end of the 1990s. Uwe called it having firm principles. They were never quite in agreement when it came to words and their meanings. He knows that she is disappointed that he and Rune could not keep the peace. He knows that the animosity between him and Rune, to some extent, ruined the possibility of Sonia and Anita becoming the great friends they could have been. But when a conflict has been going on for long enough, it can be impossible to sort out, for the simple reason that no one can remember how it first started. And Uwe didn't know how it first started. He only knew how it ended. A BMW. There must have been some people who understood it and some who didn't. There were probably people who thought there was no connection between cars and emotions. But there would never be a clearer explanation as to why these two men had become enemies for life. Of course, it had started innocently enough, not long after Uwe and Sonia came back from Spain and the accident. Uwe laid new paving stones in their little garden that summer, whereupon Rune put up a new fence around his, whereupon Uwe put up an even higher fence around his garden, whereupon Rune went off to the building supply store and a few days later started boasting all over the street that he had built a swimming pool. That was no bloody swimming pool, Uwe raged to Sonia. It was a little splash pool for Rune and Anita's newborn urchin. That was all it was. For a while, Uwe had plans to report it to the planning department as an illegal construction. But at that point, Sonia put her foot down and sent him out to mow the lawn and calm himself down. And so Uwe did just that, although it certainly did not calm him down very much at all. The lawn was oblong, about 5 yards wide, and ran along the backs of Uwe's and Rune's houses, and the house in between, which Sonia and Anita had quickly named the neutral zone. No one quite knew what that lawn was for or what function it was expected to fill. But when row housing was put up in those days, some city architect must have got the idea that there had to be lawns here and there for no other reason than that they looked so very nice in the drawings. When Uwe and Rune formed the Residents Association and were still friends, the two men decided that Uwe should be the groundsman and responsible for keeping the grass mowed. It had always been Uwe before. On one occasion, the other neighbors had proposed that the association should put out tables and benches on the lawn to create a sort of common space for all the neighbors. But obviously, Uwe and Rune put a stop to that at once. It would only turn into a bloody mess and lots of noise. And as far as that went, it was all peace and joy. At least insofar as anything could be peace and joy when men like Uwe and Rune were involved. Soon after Rune had built his pool, a rat ran across Uwe's newly mown lawn and into the trees on the other side. Uwe immediately called a crisis meeting of the association and demanded that all local residents put out rat poison around their houses. The neighbors protested, of course, because they had seen hedgehogs by the edge of the woods and were concerned that they might eat the poison. Rune also protested because he was afraid that some of it would end up in his pool. Uwe suggested to Rune that he button up his shirt and go see a psychologist about his delusions of living on the French Riviera. Rune made a malicious joke at Uwe's expense, to the effect that Uwe had probably only imagined seeing that rat. All the others laughed. Uwe never forgave Rune for that. The next morning, someone had thrown birdseed all over Rune's outside space, and Rune had to use a spade to chase away a dozen rats as big as vacuum cleaners in the next few weeks. After that, Uwe got permission to put out poison, even though Rune mumbled that he'd pay him back for this. 2 years later, Rune won the great tree conflict when he gained permission at the annual meeting to saw down a tree blocking his and Anita's evening sun on one side. The same tree on the other side screened off Uwe and Sonia's bedroom from blinding morning sunlight. Further, he managed to block Uwe's furious motion that the association would then have to pay for Uwe's new awning. However, Uwe got his revenge during the snow clearance skirmish of the following winter, in which Rune wanted to anoint himself chief of snow shoveling, and at the same time lumber the Residents Association with the purchase of a gigantic snowblower. Uwe had no intention of letting Rune walk around with some bloody contraption at the expense of the association and spray snow over Uwe's windows.
which he made crystal clear at the steering group meeting. Rune was still chosen to be responsible for snow clearance, but to his great annoyance, he had to spend all winter shoveling the snow by hand between the houses. The outcome of this, of course, was that he consistently shoveled outside all the houses in their row except Uva and Sonia's. Just to annoy Rune, in mid-January, Uva hired a gigantic snowblower to clear the 10 square yards outside his door. Rune was incandescent about it, Uva remembers with delight to this day. Of course, Rune found a way of paying it back the following summer by buying one of those monstrous lawn tractors. Then, by a combination of treachery, lies, and conspiracies, he managed to get approval at the annual meeting to take over Uva's lawnmowing responsibilities, on the grounds that he had slightly more adequate equipment than the one who was in charge of it before. As a partial restitution, Uva managed some 4 years later to stop Rune's plans of putting in new windows in his house, because after 33 letters and a dozen angry telephone calls, the planning department gave up and accepted Uva's argument that this would ruin the harmonious architectural character of the area. In the following 3 years, Rune refused to speak of Uva as anything but that bloody red tapist. Uva took it as a compliment. And the next year, he changed his own windows. When the next winter set in, the steering group decided that the area needed a new collective heating system. Quite coincidentally, of course, Rune and Uva happened to have diametrically different views of what sort of heating system was required, which was jokingly referred to by the other neighbors as the Battle of the Water Pump. It grew into an eternal struggle between the two men. And so it continued. But as Sonia used to say, there were also some other moments. There weren't many of them, but women like Sonia and Anita knew how to make the most of them. Because there hadn't always been burning conflict. One summer in the 1980s, for instance, Uva had bought a Saab 9000 and Rune a Volvo 760. And they were so pleased with this that they kept the peace for several weeks. Sonia and Anita even managed to get all four of them together for dinner on a few occasions. Rune and Anita's son, who'd had time to turn into a teenager by this stage, with all the divinely sanctioned charmlessness and impoliteness this entailed, sat at one end of the table like an irritable accessory. That boy was born angry, Sonia used to say with sadness in her voice. But Uva and Rune managed to get along so well that they even had a little whiskey together at the end of the evening. Unfortunately, at their last dinner that summer, Uva and Rune had the idea of having a barbecue, and obviously they started feuding at once about the most effective way of lighting Uva's globe grill. Within 15 minutes, the argument had escalated so much in volume that Sonia and Anita agreed it might be best to eat their dinner separately after all. The two men had time to buy and sell a Volvo 760 Turbo and a Saab 9000i before they spoke to one another again. Meanwhile, the neighbors came and went in the row of houses. In the end, there had been so many new faces in the doorways of the other row houses that they all merged in a sea of gray. Where before there had been forest, there were only construction cranes. Uva and Rune stood outside their houses, hands obstinately shoved into their trouser pockets like ancient relics in a new age. While a parade of uppity real estate agents barely able to see over their grapefruit-sized tie knots patrolled the little row between the houses and kept their eyes on them, like vultures watching aging water buffaloes. They could hardly wait to move some bloody consultant's families into their houses. Both Uva and Rune knew that very well. Rune and Anita's son moved away from home when he was 20 in the early 1990s. Apparently he went to America, Uva found out from Sonia. They hardly saw him again. From time to time, Anita had a telephone call around the time of Christmas, but he was so busy with his own things now, as Anita said when she tried to keep her spirits up, even though Sonia could see that she had to hold back her tears. Some boys leave everything behind and never look back. That was all there was to it. Rune never said anything about it, but to anyone who had known him a long time, it was as if he shrank a couple of inches in the years that followed, as if he sort of crumpled with a deep sigh and never really breathed properly again. A few years later, Rune and Uva fell out for the 100th time about that collective heating system. Uva stormed out of a residents' association meeting in a fury and never returned. The last battle the two men fought was a bit into the noughties when Rune bought one of those automated robotic lawnmowers, which he'd ordered from Asia,
and left it to whiz about on the lawn behind the houses. Rune could even remotely program it to cut special patterns, Sonia said in an impressed tone of voice one evening when she came home from visiting Anita. Uva soon caught on that this special pattern was the habit of that robotic little shit to consistently rumble back and forth all night outside Uva and Sonia's bedroom window. One evening, Sonia saw Uva fetch a screwdriver and walk out the veranda door. Next morning, the little robot, quite inexplicably, had driven right into Rune's pool. The month after, Rune went into the hospital for the first time. He never bought another lawnmower. Uva did not know himself how their animosity had begun, though he knew very well that it ended there and then. Afterwards, it was only memories for Uva, and a lack of them for Rune. And there were very likely people who thought one could not interpret men's feelings by the cars they drove. But when they moved onto the street, Uva drove a Saab 96 and Rune a Volvo 244. After the accident, Uva bought a Saab 95 so he'd have space for Sonia's wheelchair. That same year, Rune bought a Volvo 245 to have space for a stroller. 3 years later, Sonia got a more modern wheelchair and Uva bought a hatchback, a Saab 900. Rune bought a Volvo 265 because Anita had started talking about having another child. Then Uva bought two more Saab 900s and after that his first Saab 9000. Rune bought a Volvo 265 and eventually a Volvo 745 station wagon. But no more children came. One evening, Sonia came home and told Uva that Anita had been to the doctor. And a week later, a Volvo 740 stood parked in Rune's garage, the sedan model. Uva saw it when he washed his Saab. In the evening, Rune found a half bottle of whiskey outside his door. They never spoke about it. Maybe their sorrow over children that never came should have brought the two men closer. But sorrow is unreliable in that way. When people don't share it, there's a good chance that it will drive them apart instead. Maybe Uva never forgave Rune for having a son who he could not even get along with. Maybe Rune never forgave Uva for not being able to forgive him for it. Maybe neither of them forgave themselves for not being able to give the woman they loved more than anything what they wanted more than anything. Rune and Anita's lad grew up and cleared out of home as soon as he got the chance. And Rune went and bought a sporty BMW, one of those cars that only had space for two people and a handbag, because now it was only him and Anita, as he told Sonia when they met in the parking area. And one can't drive a Volvo all of one's life, he said with an attempt at a half-hearted smile. She could hear that he was trying to swallow his tears, and that was the moment when Uva realized that a part of Rune had given up forever. And for that, maybe neither Uva nor Rune forgave him. So there were certainly people who thought that feelings could not be judged by looking at cars. But they were wrong. Chapter 29 A Man Called Uva and a Bender.
Seriously, where are we going?
Harvana wonders, out of breath.
To fix something, Uva answers curtly, three steps ahead of her, with the cat half-jogging at his side.
What thing?
A thing.
Pravana stops and catches her breath.
Here!
Uva calls out and stops abruptly in front of a little cafe.
A scent of fresh-baked croissants comes through the glass door.
Pravana looks at the parking area on the other side of the street where they left the Saab. In the end, they could not have parked closer to the cafe. At first, Uva had been absolutely convinced that the cafe was at the other end of the block. That was when Parvana had suggested they could possibly park on that side, but the notion was abandoned once they found that parking cost 1 kroner more per hour. Instead, they had parked here and walked all around the block looking for the cafe. Because Uva, as Parvana had soon realized, was the sort of man who, when he was not quite certain where he was going, just carried on walking straight ahead, convinced that the road would eventually fall into line. And now, when they find that the cafe is directly opposite the spot where they parked, Uva looks as if this was his plan all along. Pravana mops some sweat off her cheek. A man with a ragged, dirty beard is leaning against a wall halfway down the street.
He has a paper cup in front of him. Outside the cafe, Uva, Parvana, and the cat meet a slim boy aged about 20, who has what looks very much like black soot around his eyes. It takes Uva a moment to realize it's the boy who was standing behind the lad with the bicycle when Uva met him the first time. He looks a little cautious. Although he smiles at Uva, Uva can't think of anything to do but nod back, as if wanting to clarify that while he has no intention of returning the smile, he is prepared to acknowledge receipt of it.
"Why didn't you let me park next to the red car?"
Parvana wants to know as they open the glass door and step inside. Uva doesn't answer.
"I would have managed it,"
she says self-confidently. Uva shakes his head wearily. 2 hours ago, she didn't know where the clutch was. Now she's irritated because he won't let her squeeze into a narrow parking space. Once they're inside the cafe, Uva sees from the corner of his eye how the slim, soot-eyed boy offers the sandwiches he's hiding to the vagrant.
"Hi there, Uva,"
a voice calls out so eagerly that it cracks into falsetto in the high notes. Uva turns around and sees the lad from the bike shed. He's standing behind a long, polished counter at the front of the premises wearing a baseball cap, Uva notes. Indoors. The cat and Parvana make themselves at home, the latter mopping sweat from her forehead, although it's ice cold in there. Colder than outside in the street, actually. She pours herself some water from a pitcher on the counter. The cat unconcernedly laps up some of it from her glass when she isn't looking.
"Do you know each other?"
Parvana asks with surprise, looking at the youth.
"Me and Uva are sort of friends,"
the youth nods.
"Are you? Me and Uva are sort of friends, too,"
Parvana grins, tenderly imitating his enthusiasm. Uva stops at a safe distance from the counter, as if someone might give him a hug if he gets too close.
"My name's Adrian," says the youth.
"Parvana,"
says Parvana.
"You want something to drink?"
he asks them.
"A latte for me, please,"
says Parvana, in a tone of voice as if she's suddenly having her shoulders massaged. She dabs her forehead with a napkin.
"Preferably an iced latte, if you have it."
Uva shifts his weight from his left foot to his right and peers around the premises. He's never liked cafes. Sonia, of course, loved them, but sit in them for an entire Sunday just looking at people, as she put it. Uva used to sit there with her reading a newspaper. Every Sunday they did it. He hasn't put his foot in a cafe since she died. He looks up and realizes that Adrian, Parvana, and the cat are waiting for his answer.
"Coffee, then. Black."
Adrian scratches his hair under the cap.
"So, espresso?"
"No, coffee."
Adrian transfers his scratching from hair to chin.
"What, like black coffee?"
"Yes."
"With milk?"
"If it's with milk, it's not black coffee."
Adrian moves a couple of sugar bowls on the counter, mainly to have something to do so he doesn't look too silly. "A bit late for that," thinks Uva.
"Normal filter coffee. Normal bloody filter coffee,"
Uva repeats. Adrian nods.
"Oh, that. Well, I don't know how to make it."
Uva points aggressively at the percolator in the corner, only barely visible behind a gigantic silver spaceship of a machine which Uva understands is what they use for making espresso.
"Oh, that one, yeah,"
says Adrian, as if the penny has just dropped.
"Ah, I don't really know how that thing works."
"Should have bloody known,"
mutters Uva as he walks around the counter and takes matters into his own hands.
"Can someone tell me what we're doing here?" calls Parvana.
"This kid here has a bicycle that needs repairing,"
explains Uva as he pours water into the carafe.
"The bicycle hanging off the back of the car."
"You brought it here?
Thanks, Uva."
"You don't have a car, do you?"
he replies, while rummaging around a cupboard for coffee filters.
"Thanks, Uva,"
says Adrian and takes a step towards him, then comes to his senses and stops before he does something silly.
"So, that's your bicycle,"
Parvana smiles.
"Kind of, it's my girlfriend's, or the one I want to be my girlfriend, sort of thing."
Parvana grins.
"So, me and Uva drove all this way just to give you a bike, so you can mend it. For a girl?"
Adrian nods. Parvana leans over the counter and pats Uva on the arm.
"You know, Uva, sometimes one almost suspects you have a heart."
"Do you have tools here or not?"
Uva says to Adrian, snatching his arm away. Adrian nods.
Go and get them, then. The bike's on the Saab in the parking lot.